So, how was the exam? Lengthy. Oh, okay. That's okay.
I mean, not many questions were like really hard, and it's a lot of them.
Good. Any other questions before we get started? I didn't understand. What? Cluster evaluation. Yeah.
If we don't have the ground truth.
You cannot, yeah, you cannot evaluate. I mean, the external evaluation cannot be done if you do not have ground truth. So what you wind up doing is you decide on a, you know, a clustering technique. I mean, this is sort of true in machine learning, I mean, in classification too, okay? So the idea is you might apply the clustering to a problem where you know the ground truth and see how it works. And then if you are happy enough that it's working there, then you just apply cold, you know, to unknown data and hope that the clusters it found actually have ground truth. Okay? It's the same thing in essence also for classification, which we'll be talking about today, but you know, several of you already know, in the sense that at the time a machine learning algorithm is actually being used, you don't know what is the right one, what's the wrong one. I mean, you almost depend on the machine learning algorithm to tell you what is the right and what's the wrong. So for example, if you are a fraud detection unit in a credit card company, you suddenly decide that a certain, a particular transaction is probably fraudulent. So you label it, yes. Okay, and only afterwards people can figure out whether or not it's actually fraudulent. Okay, the only difference between clustering and classification is even during the time clustering is, the way the clustering algorithm works, it does not actually require ground truth to generate clusters. You might evaluate clustering using ground truth, but you don't use ground truth to actually generate the clusters. Whereas in the classification, the training data, the labels of the training data are used to decide how to classify the test data. Okay? So that's the unsupervised versus supervised. Any other questions? Yes?
In exam, there should be some one more extra credit part for that. Suppose someone student is not able to do all the 5 questions, so there should be one another question based on the extra part for that.
I don't understand what you're saying.
Suppose the exam is having 5 questions, the total is 16.
Mm-hmm. So I still don't understand. So you're increasing the number of questions. You're already saying the exam is lengthy. So how does increasing more, I mean, having more questions help?
Yeah, some of the questions can be like an objective or so that you everyone can attempt 4 questions, tough and easy, and 4. So there is some comparative
between. I'm not, yeah, we can talk about this outside, but I'm not sure I understand. I mean, you're suggesting some exam philosophy, which is great to hear about, but we probably should talk about. I didn't quite get it. Okay. Other questions? This week. Okay, and it'll be due at the end of the semester, and basically it'll be due, not only would it be due, but it actually, you will have a demo for all 3 parts together to the TA, and then that would be the end of the. So that's where I said, if you did not do part one well enough or part two well enough, if they're working by the end, you get some credit because, you know, you get to demonstrate the whole working search engine. And the part three, basically, one thing, I mean, I don't quite remember, I have to look back at my thing, but you'll probably do some clustering stuff, but you are also allowed to do other new things that you want. I mean, there are some extra things that you can do yourself. Okay. Probably, yes, yeah. I mean, but I'll open it. I mean, I'll open it, and you know, only when we give it to you, you can say, you know, until now. But it's more or less, if you take a look at that, you're not going to be completely off. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I am going to today look at the remaining part of clustering and then go into classification. Text classification. Again, clustering and classification are very general topics. What we are doing here is thinking of their impact, their relation to text data, because that's what we've been looking at mostly, you know, documents. Okay, and so we were looking, I think last Tuesday we were at the end of the class, we were looking at problems with k-means. Remember the k-means idea, you come up, you know, you pick k-centroids and then you essentially, everybody joins the cluster corresponding to the centroid that they are closest to, and after the clustering is completed, then essentially you compute the centroids of each cluster, and then you and each person and each entity gets to decide which cluster it wants to join again. Okay, and you do this until you no longer, no entity wants to change clusters. At that point, you have reached some sort of a local minimum, okay, in terms of cluster tightness. Okay, so we looked at, we were starting to look at some of the problems. Actually, we looked at most of them. I'm just going to repeat them. You can, one issue with k-means, and that's something that we're going to deal with today, is that it requires k. It requires how many clusters are there in the data. And once you give a k, it will actually go and find exactly those many clusters, no less, no more. Okay. So in some sense, knowing that there are certain number of clusters is an extra piece of knowledge. So giving k makes it, it's not really unsupervised. Okay. When we said clustering is an unsupervised learning, that essentially means only data is given, nothing is given. But if I give you k, that means I'm giving you a little more information. Okay. So in fact, one of the issues that we will see is there is no, although people talk about the distinction between unsupervised versus supervised learning, this distinction is not hard and fast. Okay, you give a little more data, you will start coming from unsupervised towards supervised. Okay, so for example, giving k is giving extra information about the data. That means you are saying there actually are 5 clusters to be found in this data. Okay, and in fact, since we are talking about that, there is also this idea called, basically, between unsupervised and supervised is this notion of semi-supervised. And, you know, there's a large amount of work and which actually looks at machine learning in the semi-supervised scenarios. I would actually say k-means is, in some sense, semi-supervised, because you're telling it how many clusters to find. Okay? The other thing you can also say, for example, for semi-supervised, another way you can give more information is, suppose not only do I have these points, but I might say a little extra information about these points. For example, I might say, here are some points that cannot be together. These points will not be together. So they cannot be in the same cluster. Okay, they can't live together. They just, you know, hate each other. Okay? And similarly, there may be points that would like to be together always. Suppose I give this extra information, right? Suppose I give this information, apart from just the data, I also say must link, must not link, right? Then what happens essentially is I'm giving you extra information, more information than just the points. And then you can do clustering using that extra information. So you now are going to ensure that the clusters you came up with try to satisfy these constraints. So this is more than any arbitrary k-means. You know, it's not enough to just find k-clusters. You have to find k-clusters which tend not to put the guys with must not link constraints in the same cluster and will put the ones which are, you know, together in the same cluster. Okay? And you can think of these as soft constraints or hard constraints. If you think of it as a hard constraint, that means any cluster which has two guys who cannot be together would just be violate, you know, would be thrown out. Soft constraints means of the clusterings you have, you, for each clustering you can talk about the quality of the cluster. Previously the quality of the cluster only had this notion of internal tightness of the cluster. Now to that you can add the number of these constraints that are being violated. And a clustering that violates fewest constraints would be better than the ones that violate more constraints. Okay, so this stuff actually is actually a generalization of k-means that sort of says there is no such thing as completely unsupervised learning. There could be semi-supervised learning where you give little more information. And as I said, k is already extra information. Okay. The other thing here, of course, is I mentioned last time that trying to figure out if you're not given k, if you are trying to figure out what would be the best k to find, yes. Mm-hmm. What do you mean classification is concerned unsupervised?
Yes,
yes. I understand. That's exactly the reason why I'm bringing this up. I mean, because there is this religious distinction made between clustering and classification. You know, I'm trying to remove that religious distinction. Okay. So it's a spectrum of how much information you provide. Truly speaking, really, there is no such thing in the world, in any machine learning scenario that you come up with, which is fully, fully unsupervised. Because the moment you take the points and put them in a n-dimensional space, where you've decided what the dimensions are, that's already supervised, because you decided what are the relevant features.
Then you don't have any test data.
What? No, it's all I'm saying is these extra information. So, you know, you're deciding that unsupervised only means that there is no labeled data up front. That's one specific way of looking at it. A better way of looking at it is how much information do I have as to what is the right versus wrong thing to do. Okay? If I just give you the data, I won't even tell you how to represent them in the n-dimensional space. That's the most unsupervised thing I can do. If I represent them in the n-dimensional space, which everybody assumes you do, that's less unsupervised. If I tell you there are exactly k clusters to be found, it's even less unsupervised. If I tell you not only are there k clusters to be found, there are these pairwise constraints that are between, you know, entities that must be respected, then I'm becoming even less unsupervised. Okay, and much of the interesting work in machine learning nowadays really is in this semi-supervised thing, because there is no such thing as fully supervised versus fully unsupervised. Okay, so that's part of the reason I brought this up. Okay, so anyway, if nobody gave you k and you're trying to figure out k yourself, okay, then the problem that we mentioned was it's not enough to just try all k's and then see for each k, you know, what's the best clustering you can get, because the problem then would be that, as we mentioned, if you have n clusters where n is the number of points, if k equal to n, then at that time the internal cluster dissimilarity would be zero, because each point is its own cluster. So each cluster is dissimilar from every other cluster. You know, each cluster is perfectly homogeneous. Okay, so what happens, of course, is, remember the reason, so this is what I was pointing out last time, and then I said that's why you should look for the knee point, the place where if you are actually trying to figure out what's the right k, then you consider, you know, trying bunch of k values and see where the rate of change of cluster, internal cluster dissimilarity is slowing down. And then you pick one of those points. So that's why you could pick here, or you could put here. Those are good places to start. Okay. But a slightly more interesting way of thinking about why this problem even occurs is that, remember, when we talked about clustering, we said the internal quality of a clustering is a function of both intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance. And you have to somehow, you know, take the function and minimize that. Okay? But then for k-means, we decided we don't need to worry about inter-cluster distance because k is constant. So as long as k is constant, just considering intra-cluster tightness and sum of all the intra-cluster tightness is good enough. But if you are comparing intra-cluster tightness for k equal to 5, sum of intra-cluster tightness for k equal to 5, to that for k equal to 7, then you are not comparing apples to apples, you are comparing apples to oranges, because this one has fewer clusters and this one has more clusters. So if you really want to figure out what the k is, either you do it this way, okay, or you essentially write it as an actual optimization problem where you say the quality of the clustering is connected to, you know, you basically bring back both the intercluster and intracluster distances. Okay? Or say as the number of clusters increases, you get a penalty. Okay? And then you find over all possible clusterings, you will tend to prefer lower number of clusters. So the clusterings with fewer number of clusters, as long as their dissimilarity is not too high. So intra-cluster dissimilarity is not too high. Okay? So this is the way you would have done it if you are doing optimization. If you're doing it just to figure out a reasonable value, then you can also think in this way. You know, look for the knee point in the way the intra-cluster tightness is changing. The bigger point I want you to remember is once you change k value, then you cannot just compare intra-cluster tightness across two different k values, because then you do need to consider intercluster distance in this as well as intercluster distance in this. Take the function for both and then compare those. Those are normalized. Otherwise, they are not normalized. Okay, that's the reason. So there's no magic here. So the other thing we talked about is, you know, obviously I pointed out that, you know, k-means actually finds a local minimum, okay, in the space of intracluster tightness, even for the value, given value k. And part of the reason is it depends on which centers you start from, and this is the last thing I mentioned at the end of last class, that for example, if you start with B and E as the centers in these four, in these 6 points, assume geometric distances, the Euclidean distances are the distance measures for this. Okay? So if you start with B and E as the centers, okay, then clearly you would find ABC as one cluster and DEF as another cluster. Whereas if you were to take D and F as the cluster centers, then you will find these four as one cluster and these four as one cluster. Now, it's possible that based on the ground truth for the problem, one of those clusterings is the correct one and the other one is the wrong one. The point we're trying to make is based on the initial centroids, you may not ever find a particular clustering. Okay? And if it turns out that that one is going to wind up overall having lower intra-cluster dissimilarity, then you would basically not find it. So the only way you could actually, you know, if you started with B and E, you are stuck with this cluster and this cluster. Whereas I might say that this cluster and this cluster are much better because these are closer to each other and these are closer to each other. And they're far away from each other. You know, this cluster and this cluster are far away from each other. And you will never find it if you started from B and E. So that's why if you want to get you know, the globally minimal clustering, even for the same value of K, you have to try different values of cluster centers. So normally, one way, in fact, we will talk about something called bisecting k-means in a, you know, a little while later, but what that does and that you can do even now is, suppose I just have some amount of data and I want to convert, I want to split it into just two clusters, okay? So what I can do is do n equal to 1 to, no, m equal to 1 to the number of iterations, pick two centers, do k-means, find the best clustering. Remember it. Okay? And then go back to n equal to 2. Again pick two more centers. Do the k-means again. Find the best clustering. Remember it. And then whichever, if the next clustering is better than the previous clustering, then you only keep that. So that by end of n iterations, by the end of all these iterations, you would have done k-means on the data m times, iteration number of times. Okay? And then you across all of them, you're trying to find out which is the best intra-cluster dissimilarity you're able to get. Did you guys get that? So it's just you're doing extra work, essentially. Okay, so this is sort of, it's a hill climbing strategy. So those of you who remember hill climbing search know that one way you can avoid local minima for hill climbing is to do random restart. Okay, based on one point, you may get stuck somewhere. So you then teleport yourself to somewhere else and then try again. Teleport yourself to somewhere else and try again. And each iteration, all you need to remember is what's the altitude of the point you got to at the end. Okay, among all these, J iterations, you pick for a point that has the highest altitude and say that's the one that I take as the best solution I found till now. Okay, so this is actually this idea is used in what's called a bisecting k-means. Let me actually, since I mentioned this, even though I'll show you the slide in a little while later, but the way bisecting k-means works, I'll show you the slide a little later, but let me just, since I bring this up right now. What bisecting k-means does is it starts with the data, starts with all the data, okay, and picks a cluster randomly, bisect it. That means in the beginning there's only one cluster because all data is in one cluster, right? So then anytime you made two clusters, then the next iteration you can pick either of those clusters, for example. Okay, so when you pick a cluster, you can bisect it. Bisect it means do k equal to 2 clustering. But when you bisect it, you do this process. That means you try to bisect it by trying multiple initial centers. Like 5 times I'll find initial centers, find the best clustering I get with that way, and then commit to it. Okay, now one of the interesting things is, in fact, if you do that kind of a bisecting clustering, what do you think will happen? You start with all points. All pens are bad. You start with all points in the beginning. Then you split it into, let's say, this cluster and this cluster, C1 and C2. Then suppose you pick C1, you split it into C11, C12. Then if I pick this, then I split it into C21, C22. Then if I continue doing this, I can pick this into C211, C212. What I'm getting here is not only am I getting, I can say these are the clusters, the leaf nodes are the clusters, but I can also actually say that I clustered the data in an hierarchical fashion. Okay, so in some sense, these two clusters are really part of this big cluster, which is part of this big cluster, which is part of all the points. Okay, so bisecting k-means, we will revisit it in a few minutes, and we'll call it, it's a hierarchical clustering technique. It's a divisive hierarchical clustering technique. It starts with all the data and splits it into, smaller and smaller sets. The reason I brought it up here was because as part of bisecting, it tries to run the clustering multiple times with, only two centers. Try any two random centers, find the best clustering. Find another two random centers, find the best clustering. Do this about, say, 5 times. And find among all these two clusters, which one has the lowest intra-cluster tightness, intra-cluster dissimilarity, and commit to that. That's bisecting k-means. Okay, one other thing that k-means has, is K means is exhaustive and it's disjoint. You know, every point is in a unique cluster. It's never in two clusters. Okay? And then every point must be in a cluster. You can't leave out any point. Okay? Now what that actually means sometimes, is there's this problem called, of course there's two issues. One is sometimes a point is, I'm going to remove this now. Those are the points, let's say. Now, clearly, there is a cluster here. You can see it. There's a cluster here. But this point could have been in either cluster. And by forcing it to choose a cluster, you'll wind up essentially, you know, winding up changing the cluster shape unnecessarily sometimes. So you might be better off allowing what's called soft clusters. Soft clusters where each point has a fractional membership. Fractional membership in more than one cluster. Now, if you can tell me in this class, effectively we talked once at least, if not more than once, about a soft clustering idea. I mean, we used it without saying it's a soft clustering. If you can tell me that, I'll be very happy. I might even give you some extra points on something or other. Do you guys remember, have we thought about soft clustering? So I'm talking about a point now being in more than one cluster. K-means doesn't do it. It always puts each point in a different cluster. In this class, we talked about what? Exactly. So you get extra points. Remind me. When you know, not getting an A+ or something, you can come back and ask me. But that's true because, you know, in the topic-related, topic-specific page rank, remember, each query can have fractional membership in multiple possible topics. And you take the page rank of a page for that query as the, if you have K topics, we assumed each page has K different page ranks. One page rank corresponding to each topic. And each query has fractional membership in each of the topics. In the special case, it has exactly one, you know, in one membership and zero in every other. I mean, one cluster, it belongs to one topic fully and doesn't belong to any other topic. But more generally, it might belong 0.7 to this, 0.3 to this, 0.7 to this, 0.2 to this, and 0.1 to this. Okay? So that will add up to one. Now what I would say is the effective page rank of a page now is going to be 0.7 times its topic 1's page rank plus 0.2 times the topic 2's page rank and 0.1 times topic 3's page rank. Okay, now when I did the topics, right, you just assume somehow those things were given to you, but how would you figure out the topics? That's a clustering issue. Okay, topics, making topics in up, you know, given, you know, like for example, if you're making a directory of all the topics in the web, that's a clustering issue. And there may be some pages which belong to more than one topic. That's a fractional membership issue. So we always talked about clustering before. We are only talking about the actual ways of doing it here. Okay, so you do see that K-means doesn't allow soft clustering the way it currently is, and that's a problem, in fact, because you would like to support soft clusters in some cases. Actually, yes? That's a different story. It could also be real points. Okay, so now if you want to say they are noise, so in fact this, I'll give you a different idea. So I will grade this exam, let's say, that you just did, right? And there would be somebody who got 100, the next person got 62. I'm not saying I'll make it happen that way. I mean, I have had exams where this happened multiple times. And then 61.5, 60.5, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, 41 and, you know, 2 and 0, you know, there's a nice number of things. Now, I'm trying to decide to split this into A, B, C, D clusters. Okay, I'm sure if you know the name of this person, you would like to talk to them, right? Because they are outliers. They are changing the curve. Okay? If I think of them as, oh, this person really should not be considered as part of the class, right? Then all these guys can get an A plus or A or whatever. Okay? By keeping this person in, I will wind up changing the clustering. And some people will be unhappy. Okay, in this particular case, you might say this person is outlier. Okay, and you know, sometimes, you know, actually the data point was noisily measured, and so it really is an outlier. In this case, maybe all that mistake that this person did is probably they were smart enough to answer everything. Okay, but in general, you could actually have a point which should not really be, which was just wrongly measured. And so it really should not be taken into consideration in making the cluster. Okay? And k-means will take every point into consideration. Because every point should belong to a cluster. Okay? Now, outlier problem is a pretty big problem, but in general, k-means kind of clustering, the way you can handle it, one easy way to handle it conceptually is what? There is k-means. The problem with k-means is not k, but the means. Okay? Arithmetic mean is sensitive to outliers. Have you ever wondered why people talk about median income of households in the US? Because Bill Gates exists. Bill Gates is a painfully bad guy. You know, if you add his stuff also and divide it by the number of people, then we'll be much richer. In some sense, and even though none of our lives have improved, the average income of this country would go up like significantly because this guy is a huge outlier sitting there. Okay, and the richer he becomes, the arithmetic mean will keep going richer and richer. So to avoid that, we talk about median incomes. So however much, you know, Bill Gates makes next year, you know, because Microsoft stock going up, the median income is not going to change. Because he's already an outlier. And he will keep going farther and farther. A median is the midpoint of all the incomes when they're put in the sorted order. So if you take, instead of k-means, k-medoid algorithm. That means the cluster centers are based on the medians rather than the means. Then you'll be fine. You would actually be quite insensitive to outliers. What's the problem?
So this is the pre-processing of the noise, like you remove that mean?
No, I'm not. No, I'm just saying that when you have a cluster, right, for example, right, suppose you were essentially doing clustering of the household incomes. Remember, after all, we do have household incomes clustered into upper middle class, filthy rich, upper middle class, lower middle class, and really poor. Right? It's what? 1, 2, 3, 4. I kind of made up 5 classes. Okay? So if I give you the incomes of people in US, right, and I'm trying to do it into K clusters, if I do K means clustering, then each cluster I have would be represented by its centroid. If I do K medians clustering, then each cluster would be represented by the median of it. Okay, and that changes the way, you know, the outliers affect. Because, you know, for example, in a cluster, let's say in the upper middle class section, you know, obviously Bill Gates would be one of the people in that cluster. But even if, you know, his income increases by a couple of extra $1 billion next year, the median of this cluster won't change. Because he's still outlier and he becomes even more of an outlier. We are still taking them into account. Remember, we are taking them into account. Median does take into account the fact that Bill Gates is one of the people. That's why you put them all in a sorted order and pick the middle point. The problem with medians is what? No, how long does it take? Yes, sir. No, I didn't get it. I did not go to your side. Repeat what you said.
So if you have a cluster, like let's say you're trying to find two clusters in an area that's really got four clusters.
Mm-hmm.
So you draw two clusters, and then each one has two subclusters. If one has one more than the other, then the median will be skewed entirely over to that side.
That's, yeah, one thing. But think about efficiency issues. Okay, but think also of the computational issues. Medians, how long does it take to find the median of endpoints versus how long does it take to find a mean of endpoints? To find the median, you really essentially have to sort the data. You have to almost sort the data. So, in fact, median requires linear amount of processing on the data. Right? Whereas mean is O1 processing, add them up. Okay, so you don't need to sort the data. So this is why k-mediated algorithm is not used. Instead, you use other things like neighborhood, region-based k-means clustering, etc. But I want you to understand that outliers pose a big problem in clustering. Outliers change the way the clustering has changed. You know, I'll send you, when I go back, I'll send you, you know, a hypothetical example of midterm points. You know, there were other times when this course was start, it just would so happen, just like today, that we would be discussing k-means right after the midterm is over. So I could use the midterm marks of the people to show the idea of outliers. Right? And it changes who gets A's and who gets B's just because of the outlier getting extra few points. Okay? And that you can't change it. Okay, and then the last one, we already mentioned that, you know, the clustering is, you know, k-means assumes clusters are spherical in vector space, and it's also sensitive to the coordinate changes, weighting, etc., because means depend on scaling. Okay, so there are enough issues with, you know, k-means, but the one that I actually want to focus more on in the next topic is hierarchical clustering, where you don't need to be given k. Okay, because knowing how many clusters to find is a powerful extra information, which sometimes might be present, sometimes may not be present. And when it's not present, forcing an expert to tell you exactly how many clusters you're supposed to find is a problem. Think about, you know, in your project, in the third part of this project, right, you could do, essentially you will take the search results and cluster them into topics. Now, I gave you, let's say, Bush as the query. You presumably got a whole bunch of George W. Bush pages. You got a bunch of George H. W. Bush pages. And you also got Kalahari Bushman pages. Those are exactly three clusters. But you didn't know that upfront. If you look for five clusters, you will find five clusters. If you look for eight clusters, you will find eight clusters. What you really should do is look at the data and decide what is the right number of clusters for them. Okay, that you can't do with k-means because it expects a k. So a different way of doing it, by the way, so one other thing to think of in terms of time complexity of k-means is essentially it's linear in all the factors. The running complexity of k-means is linear in all the factors. It's linear in the number of iterations. It's linear in the number of clusters. It's linear in the dimensionality of the vectors. It's linear in the number of data points. N is the number of data points. M is the dimensionality of each of the data points. And K is the number of clusters. And I is the number of iterations you are running in the k-means. And it turns out to be linear. Okay, we will talk now about this hierarchical clustering algorithm, which unfortunately winds up being, which takes care of this problem of requiring k to be given, but it becomes quadratic in the number of data points. Okay, and then we will talk about a couple of hybrid algorithms which try to bring it down to again, you know, order n complexity. Okay, so what's hierarchical clustering? You essentially just say that the point of clustering is not to find exactly five clusters. We'll still think about hard clustering. That means each point is in exactly one cluster. Okay? But what we will assume is our idea is to organize the points, okay, such that you have a big cluster which becomes small, two small clusters, let's say, each of these two small clusters have structure and so on until you get to the real points. Okay, so what you really want to do is these are the points, you might say these two are a cluster, these three are then again a cluster, these four would become another cluster and so on. Okay, and from the top, when you are at the very top here, this will basically be the cluster of all the points. This is hierarchical clustering. Now the question is how to decide, generate this hierarchical clustering. If I start from the top and split it, it's called divisive hierarchical clustering. So you start with a big cluster and make it into smaller and smaller pieces until each leaf becomes a single node. Okay? The other way around is you start bottom up. You start from individual points, start merging them until, you know, eventually you merge everything into one super cluster. And the order of merges basically, so for example, if I say I looked at these and say, oh, I think 2 and 4 are very close, let me merge them. When I did that, then essentially I still have these points, and instead of these two points, I have this cluster. And then the next iteration I'll say, well, this cluster and this point are close together, so let me merge them. Okay, that is basically bottom up, and that's called agglomerative clustering. That means you're starting from the points and, you know, glomming them together to make it a bigger cluster. Okay, of this, in fact, I already told you the divisive clustering, which is starting from here and going to the leaves. That's the bisecting k-means. Okay, the idea of bisecting k-means that I showed you, which actually I'll get back to again as a slide in a minute, but I already talked to you about that algorithm. That essentially starts here and splits data. That's one way of splitting the data such that everything is a leaf node. And it'll give you this, you know, structure of the hierarchical structure of the clusters. Just a second. Okay? And the other one that I'm going to talk today, right now, is hierarchical agglomerative clustering, which is starting from the bottom and combining them, the bottom-up approach. Now, one interesting thing is, if I give you this, either I go this way or this way, eventually I have not just k clusters, but a structuring of the data such that it is hierarchically organized. How you decided the hierarchy can be starting from the top and dividing it, or starting from the bottom and, you know, merging it. But what you have is this. Now, why does this take care of the issue of what is the k? If I give you this, why does this take care of the issue of, you know, I don't, that means if I give you this, I basic point I'm making is you no longer need to tell me, you no longer need to be told what is the number of clusters k that you are trying to find. Because in essence, what's happening is if I give you this, if I now want to find 5 clusters, I can find the 5 clusters. Okay, what do? I go to this and put a cross section where 5 lines are crossing that. That would be those 5 clusters. Okay, so for example, let me see, where am I? Oh, actually, I don't have it yet. So, for example, if I cut like this, right, those are 3 clusters. If I cut here, that's exactly 1 cluster. If I cut here, then that's 2 clusters. So I have effectively given you all the best way of doing one clustering, which is all the data together, the best way according to me of doing 2 clusterings, which is this, okay, and the best way of doing 3 clusters, which is this, and so on, and best way of doing n clusters, which is this. That's what I'm doing. That's why I don't need you to tell me what is the number of clusters, because you can now look up. Okay, that's the basic point. Okay. So I already told you the bisecting k-means. I want to talk about this agglomerative one. The trick about agglomerative one essentially is, again, it's based on distances. Okay, you start with, you know, any 2 points, including, and so you always, in front of you, you always have a set of clusters, including singleton clusters. In the beginning, every point is its own cluster. So you have n singleton clusters. And then what you do is pick two clusters that you think are the closest to each other among all these clusters. Merge them. Okay? So I take, let's say this is C1, etc. to CN. I take CI and CJ and merge them into the cluster CI, CJ. So now I am looking at, now as far as my list is concerned, it has C1, etc. to CN, but CI and CJ no longer exist. I have this cluster CI, CJ. I look again to see which are the two closest clusters that I should merge. Okay, when I'm talking about the closest clusters, the basic idea, the basic question I'm asking is distance question. If I have singleton clusters, it's easy to answer. If I have two singleton clusters, the ones, their distance would be the distance between those two points. And if you have decided which distance to use for text data, you might, let's say, use cosine theta similarity. Okay, so then you would just use that. What is tricky is you also need to answer the question, if I have a C1 like this and a C2 like this, what is the distance between those two clusters? Because more generally, this is what you need to answer. That's where all the interesting problems come, which we talked about earlier, that when you have two clusters, the way you define the distances between those two clusters changes the type of the clusters you will find. For example, I could say the distance between these two clusters is the distance between the two closest points, the cluster. That's a single link clustering. Or I can say it is the distance between the two farthest points in each cluster. That would be the complete link clustering. Or I could say it is the average of the distances between any pair of points between these two clusters. That would be the group average clustering. Okay? Now, based on the way you decide how, you know, the based on the way you define the distance between the clusters, you change the shapes of the clusters. Okay? As an example, so here is an example for one-dimensional case. So what did we do here? We started with 1, 2, 5, 6, and 7. And we are going to first look for two closest clusters and merge. In the beginning, all clusters are singleton clusters. Okay? Now 1 and 2 are close. Of course, 5 and 6 are equally close. 6 and 7 are equally close. Tie breaking is arbitrary. Okay? So I just pick, let's say, 1 and 2. So then I cluster that. So in some sense, I have a new cluster which has centroid 1.5, 5, 6, and 7. Now, when I said 1.5, really, I should actually write it as 1 and 2, because by saying 1.5, I'm already saying I'm going to decide the distance between the clusters in terms of the centroidal distance. So that's not necessary. Okay? So in this case, if I do centroidal distance, then 1.5, 5, 6, and 7. Next, I will pick, let's say, 5, 6. Okay? Because those are the closest to each other, of course. I mean, 6 and 7 are also closest to each other. So then that will become 1.5, 5.57. Now I will then decide that these two are close to each other, and so I'll combine those. So 5.5 and 7 are close to each other. So now my super cluster here is 5, 6, and 7, and then there's 1, 2. Now there are only two clusters left, you combine them. So the hierarchical organization would be 1 and 2 are combined, 5 and 6 are combined, 7 is combined to 5 and 6, these two clusters are combined. That's how you got the hierarchical structure. Okay? Now the point I want to make is, in this case, I use centroidal distance without particularly justifying it. But as I said, you know, you could also define it in terms of single link or complete link or group average. And so to just show you how much of a difference it can make, I did mention, remember, that single link versus complete link. Single link, which is the closest two points in the two clusters, that tends to make clusters which are chain shaped. Remember the way people cross the red lights. They think that they're kind of connected to the car in front of them. So if the car, the very front car, was able to make a green, you know, green arrow, left on the green arrow, then they think, since we are behind this next car, then all of them act like a big train and just cross over. That's because they're doing single link clustering. Okay? Now in this case, suppose I have points like this. Okay? Now let's say if I were to do single link clustering, what do? Now obviously I have to pick any two points. In the beginning they're all individual. In the beginning there you actually have singleton clusters. So that means each of these are clusters by themselves. Okay? And then of course when they have singleton clusters, single link versus multi-link give the same distance. In fact, all of them give the same distance. Single link, multi-link, group average will give the same distance if you have singleton clusters. Okay? So you can easily see that in the first K, you will wind up making these into clusters. That much is clear. Then now you are stuck with having to combine clusters. If you're using single link, which clusters are you going to combine? The top two, because these two guys are close to each other, these two guys are close to each other. If I was doing complete link, which ones would I combine? The diagonal one, because basically what you need to look at is, if you're doing complete link, this is this far, these two are this far from each other. Whereas these two are only really this far from each other. Do you see that? So if you do complete link, this will become one, this will become one. If you do single link, this will become one cluster, this will become one cluster. That's exactly, single link is that. And then of course, now there are only two clusters and you combine them into one. Okay. Whereas if you do complete link example, again the first four would be the same. Now this becomes a cluster, and then the whole thing will be one cluster. So the point I'm making is, a syntactic decision you made as to how cluster distances, inter-cluster distances decided, is going to change the semantics of what clusters would represent. Okay? And that's part of the issue. Okay, now, you have to sort of decide what would be the right distance measure, you know, for the application that you have. If you're not, then you just use something and then live with the clusters it gives. Okay, the last thing that I mentioned is the group average. Of course, I can also do centroidal clustering. That is simple. I mean, I don't need to show centroidal clustering's example, but centroidal clustering would have said, this cluster is really represented by that point, this cluster is represented by that point. And the distance between the two clusters is just the distance between the centroids. Okay, the other one is the group average clustering, and there's an interesting point to be made about that, because in the case of group average clustering, to just compute the distance between two clusters, you have to consider all pairs across both the clusters. If there are n points in this, m points in this, you do n times m distance computation and then find the average. Okay? This is a point I made earlier, that it just so happens, so if you have a cluster of size C1, another cluster of size C2, then you will, to compute that group average distance, you have to take a document corresponding to C1, document corresponding to D2. We are thinking in terms of documents because we're doing clustering over documents. And then take the dot product between DI and DJ. Basically, that's what your cosine theta metric is. It takes dot product and normalizes it. Now, it so happens that if I take DI from here and DJ from here and I take the dot product, and there are two summations here, now this summation only depends on DJ, this summation only depends on DI, okay? And because of the fact that we're doing dot product, you actually can shift the summations. I can say it is, this whole thing can be written as this times this. Okay? And it actually should not be centroid square, but this then will be the centroid of the first cluster. This would be a centroid of the second cluster. So what I'm saying is, basically taking the dot product between the two centroids is like taking the dot product between every pair of points and averaging it. And this happens to be true for the dot product matrix. You know, cosine theta is one of them. Okay? And in fact, this should not be called centroid square. This should be centroid 1 dot centroid 2. That's what it should be. Okay? Any questions on this stuff? Okay. The hierarchical clustering we talked about till now, as I said, it can be using single link, or complete link, or group average, or the centroid distance. These two turn out to be the same for the cosine theta similarity metric. Now, this is basically a deterministic approach. It will always find essentially the same clustering modulo the tie breaking. Okay? Because you are not picking centers for clusters like in, you know, k-means. Okay? However, it takes, you can show that it takes n square time. It's not O n, but n square time, where n is the number of data points. Okay? So it looks like you don't have to ask for the value k if you don't mind doing O n square computation. Now, it turns out that there is an idea called Buckshot algorithm, which I'm mentioning right now, which essentially combines hack and k-means clustering and tries to do the clustering in an O n time again. Okay? So the reason you don't like k-means is you don't know what is the right k to take. Okay? And the reason you don't like hack is because it takes n square amount of computation. So what Buckshot algorithm does, and there's like, you know, a huge number of clustering algorithms. I'm just giving the ones that are close enough to that. The two main algorithms you want to remember is k-means and hierarchical agglomerative clustering. With respect to k-means, there are slight variations such as bisecting k-means. With respect to hierarchical agglomerative clustering, there is this variation called Buckshot algorithm. Okay? And what you're doing here is you do hierarchical agglomerative clustering on the data to figure out the best initial centers, best k initial centers, and then run the k means on those initial centers. Okay? And to do that, of course, now if you do it without too much thinking, then you would actually have done O n square processing for the hack part, and then again O n processing for the k means part. That's not what you want to do. Since in this approach, essentially hierarchical agglomerative clustering is only being used to decide what's the best initial centers to start with. Okay, and to do that, I would basically take square root n of the n points. So if there are n points, then I take square root of them and then sample them. Basically, just get a sample of psi square root of the n number of points. Why square root of n? Because if you run hack, it will become square root of n squared, that will become O of n. Okay, you take square root of n sample point, then run hack on it. Then if you are looking for k centers, you go through this and find the k best clusters, and then find the centers for those clusters. Or find points from each of those clusters and run the k means with that. Okay? So this one actually doesn't remove the need for k, but it removes the need for starting with the right centers, because you essentially ensure that the k centers you start from are in k different, hopefully k different clusters, at least as found on the sampling of the data. Square root and sample of the data. Okay? What? Okay, so there is a, so it turns out, I'll show you in a minute, but I mean, there's also a paper that you can read. Somebody actually looked at the performance of these four algorithms on text data and essentially said bisecting and Buckshot are better than the other two. And in doing so, they wind up using both internal and external measures of evaluation. Okay. Now, when they do external measures of evaluation, it depends on what data they evaluated it on. You know, this is a Steinbeck paper. I actually have a link to it from the clustering. And if you read that, they will essentially compare all of these on a corpus of text documents for which they know the true clustering and see which one works well.
Did you just say that Buckshot is better than
bisecting? Yes. Buckshot and bisecting k-means were found to be better. But it's better in sort of an empirical sense, not computational sense. Okay? This is the bisecting k-means. I want to show it to you. I mean, I have written this on the board, but it exists here. Okay? And essentially, for I equal to k minus 1, if you are trying to find k clusters, pick a leaf cluster C to split, and, you know, since you're splitting into two parts, then you just take two points in that cluster, make them the initial centers and do the clustering. And then do it iteration number of times and then find the best clustering you get in these. So let's say iteration is 5, then you try to split this clustering into 2 clusters, starting with 5 different pairs of initial centers. And whichever clustering is the best, and here you are comparing apples to apples, because all of them are k equal to 2. So you don't need to worry about inter-cluster distance. So you just can talk about intra-cluster dissimilarity, sum of intra-cluster dissimilarity. Whoever finds the best intra-cluster dissimilarity, that would be the center that you would commit to. Now, obviously, this is not going to make sure that those are the very best two centers. It's just making sure that, you know, you did randomly selected a pair of centers 5 different times and found the best clustering that you would get each time and then took the best of those. Okay? And so you do this, and if I do this one here, I'm saying I equal to k minus 1. This is to split it into exactly k clusters. To make this into a hierarchical clustering algorithm, I just need to make this into n minus 1, where n is the number of points. Then it would have clustered the points into n clusters eventually. So you will keep splitting until every cluster becomes exactly 1 point. Okay? So this is an example of divisive hierarchical clustering method using k-means. Yes?
So for each of the k-means that you're doing inside of the iteration, can't you also combine it with like the buckshot?
You could do it, but again, you know, if I give you 4 algorithms, you can combine them in various ways. But the out of the box, I think the default assumption is you just they don't say what you mean. The algorithm description doesn't quite tell you which k-means you should use. You assume default.
Wouldn't it be better though if buckshot's better?
You could. You could. Yeah. But I mean, remember, buckshot depends on being able to, you know, the thing about buckshot is this. Okay. Why don't we do census by doing sampling? I mean, we are going through census time, right? And why is it that people, everybody has to say whether they exist or not? I mean, you know, why not just do square root of n sampling? You know, square root of n would be only square root of the population. In fact, better even, you know, fourth root of population, and then just make them give the data, extrapolate it. Okay? In fact, there are interesting arguments saying, believe it or not, that the sampled census can be more accurate than census where people send, and some of them just don't feel like sending it. And so in fact, there are certain parts of the population, in particular, for example, homeless population, is very unlikely to actually have an address to get the census form, and so they don't get counted. Whereas if you sample such that you only get to ask 100 people in the world, in US, you'd also make, 1,000 people in the US, then you'll probably also have at least one homeless person, because, you know, of the 1,000 different kinds of people, one type of person is a homeless person. Okay? So in fact, sample-based census actually could be better if you do the sampling correct. Okay? So in as good as hack is, it depends on getting a true sample of size square root n of the data. Okay, now in fact, you know, as long as I'm talking about census based on sampling, you can also say voting based on sampling. Why is that wrong? Right? In fact, it might actually be, you know, if you really think of like 2004 and 2000 elections, one can say a sample based, you know, outcome is probably more relevant than the actual outcome, because the actual outcome involved people making mistakes, such as, you know, which one they're supposed to click. Okay, but let me not get into that. But the point is, samples, getting correct samples on a large data is a technically challenging topic. Right? I mean, when in India, towards the end of, I guess, late 80s and 90s, when people started deciding that they should also do sampling, they would randomly call people by phone to ask their opinion. It turns out very few people actually have phones in India. So when you call people by phone, you self-selecting people with phones who tend to be rich, right? And so it's very hard to get a good sample, it turns out, you know, if you're not careful. And of course, statistics, the whole area of statistics talks about getting the right kind of samples, and in particular, getting the representative samples on the web data is quite hard. Oftentimes, you don't have all the data in front of you. You need to send a probing query to some, you know, the web or the database out there. And which probing queries should you generate such that you get the correct sample?
So
So as good as this looks, it has its own problems, you know, how to get the sample. Okay. So text clustering, the summary that we have done till now is, you know, hierarchical agglomerated clustering and k-means are the two of the more classical techniques. There are a whole bunch of other techniques, you know, but you know, these are two of the more classical techniques. And they have both been applied to text clustering. And normally when you apply to text clustering, you use TF-IDF weighted vectors and the cosine theta similarity as the distance metric. And now, of course, as I mentioned in the very beginning of the clustering, it's not enough to just say, I have a cluster, do you want it? You want to give me a description of the cluster. And I talked about this, you know, in the beginning lecture, but you know, this is an important bullet point. If you make clusters for your project 3, you need to show me a description of your cluster so that I can decide whether I want to click on that cluster or some other cluster. Looking at all the clusters completely to decide which one is like more useful for me is like looking at the first 1,000 results all and then deciding which are the good results for me. Okay, so in deciding the cluster summaries, one idea, of course, is get the words that are very frequent within the cluster and very infrequent across the cluster. So cluster frequency and inverse cluster frequency is, you know, is what you wind up using. Okay, and then of course, you know, if you're doing this on large scale, you know, large number of documents and so on, you have to obviously optimize the distance computations over sparse vectors, because most of these are going to be sparse vectors. You know, for example, a document is an n-dimensional vector where n is the vocabulary size, right? And so you need to make sure that you know how to deal with sparse vectors well. And we talked about the applications during the retrieval. You can sort of show the cluster so that it increases the diversity of the results presented. You can also take all the data of the web, a sample of the data of the web, and generate a hierarchical clustering on it, and that would be the directory, DMOS project. Okay, and having generated the hierarchical clustering, then you can start saying what this cluster is supposed to mean by doing this kind of a summary on that cluster. And then that will tell you, this looks like it's about sports, this looks like it's about science. The clustering algorithm itself doesn't know what it's doing. It's just doing the distances between points. Okay? So that's what this one is. Okay. So I'm going to stop clustering here, and in the next, I think, 10 minutes or so, I will start the discussion of text classification, which is, again, one more classical topic in machine learning, but, you know, basically a supervised learning scenario, but I want to do this for text and talk about some obvious points, you know, which of the many text classification algorithms, many classification algorithms are reasonably well suited for text data. Okay, again, you know, there's a lot that's going on in clustering even as we speak. Those are just classical algorithms, and in fact, there's a huge amount of new work that's being done even as we speak. Okay, I didn't mention much of that. And similarly for the classification too, I'll tell you the classical algorithms that do work well, but there is again a lot that's going on. That, you know, if you're into text mining, that, you know, you can follow that. Okay, so the difference between classification and clustering is, in one case, you're just given the data. No information, additional information. In the clustering case, in the classification case, you're given the data and you say, this subset of the data has this label, this subset of the data is this label, this subset of the data is this label. The assumption then is when I give you a new data point, you should be able to tell me what should be its label. Which cluster does it belong to? Okay, that's what you're trying to do. So it's supervised in the sense that initially the training data has been given labels. You know which clusters they actually belong to. Okay, and then you are essentially trying to find out, given a new data point, which cluster it's supposed to belong to. Okay, now notice that even before I start, if you look at classification learning from the point of view of clustering, it almost looks as if you don't need a separate idea. Why? Because here are all the points. Okay, those are the points, let's say, total. And I just tell you the green points are the green ones and the black points are the black ones. So those are two clusters. Now, I give you a new point whose color you can't tell, okay? What is its color supposed to be? Why did you say that? Because you decided it's close to this cluster. Does this require an entire new lecture? No. You know, essentially, if you think of classification from this point of view, essentially the training data in the classifier gives you the clusters already. Okay? And given a new point, figuring out what its color, what its label should be, is saying which cluster would you have put it. Okay? Now, of course, remember the following thing, you know, suppose there are a total of 1 billion points, and the training data essentially gave me 100 points on their colors. I hope that the 100 points were sampled well. Okay, because within the 100 points, maybe there's only a green and a black. Okay, but in the 1 billion points, there are actually other labels. And in fact, there may be a point which doesn't belong to either of these clusters. If, for example, let's say the following, I give you this point here. What does that belong to? Why? You are into black. I mean, it's not very clear to me. This thing is like, you know, I mean, it's so far away from both these clusters. I have no idea what this is supposed to belong to if I go by distance. Maybe if I knew enough of these points, they would have made a cluster here. This is a problem that you have. So the assumption is if the training data was massive enough, then classification learning is actually much simpler, because then you already know the clusters, and then the new point, you just need to decide what it is closest to. Now, let's talk about this notion of closest to. Suppose I have this point, right, and I'm trying to decide what cluster it is closest to, right? How did you decide it is this? Well, again, who is the representative of these clusters? I can do centroidal distance. That means there is a centroid for this guy, there is a centroid for this guy, and there is a centroid for this guy, and I just find the distance of this point to these two centroids, and whichever it is closest to, it just becomes part of that label. That cluster, and the cluster has a label, so it will get that label. I can do neighbors, k nearest neighbors. Right? So this point will compare itself, it will find among all these points, it will find the k points that are closest to it. And then ask them which of them, you know, what's the majority color among those k points. Whichever is the majority color, it says that's my color. Okay? That's a different way. So that's called k-nearest neighbor. By the way, k-nearest neighbor is a proper learning algorithm. People actually use it, and it has a pretty useful characteristics in some cases. Okay? Now, the centroidal learning, which you also thought was a very simple idea, I'll cross over this and show you what's called relevance feedback, which is a great idea that people have thought about before. You know, I could have mentioned this in the context of information retrieval lectures, but it's actually a classification idea. Okay, so here is the idea. Suppose the user, remember we are talking about IR, right? In the IR, there was a query. Oh gosh, okay, there's a query, Q. The initial query Q, given by initial user U, the query Q given by user U, okay, and what is IR trying to find? Look at all the documents in the world, split them into two clusters, relevant cluster, irrelevant cluster, and show some representatives from the relevant cluster. That's what information retrieval is all about, finding relevant cluster. Okay? Now, the problem, of course, is if, in fact, to be able to do this correctly, you should have asked the user, okay, you want to say Q is your query, okay, here are 100 documents, D1 to D10. Do you call this relevant? You ask the user. And the user might say, this is relevant, this is irrelevant, this is relevant, this is relevant, and this is irrelevant. In which case, you will wind up having now training data. Once I have the training data, I'll actually take the centroid of the relevant documents, centroid of the irrelevant documents, and given a new point, a new document, I can decide whether it's going to be relevant or irrelevant. So you almost can ignore the query. Remember, query is just the beginning of what the user is looking for. They looked at the documents and decided what are relevant or irrelevant. Now in normal IR, the users just give you query. They never really tell you what documents are relevant to them. However, when I show using my old techniques, the cosine theta similarity and vector similarity techniques, suppose I showed the first 10 documents in the page, in the first page. The user sort of clicked on this, and also probably didn't like this. I mean, suppose, you know, in the best case, user actually said in the top 10 that you showed to the user, which ones they like, which ones they don't like. So in essence, after the first iteration, they gave you more labels. Now you're going to get the next 10 documents. Why must I use this query to get the next 10 documents? Now I actually know what the user is really looking into. He's looking into this, this, and this, and doesn't like these and these. Now, one of the nice things in IR is query queue is a vector. Documents are also vectors. Okay? Instead of resending, you know, when in the bottom of the Google or any search engine it says next 10, do you know whether they have already computed the next 10 and they're just waiting to show it to you and couldn't show you until now because there is no space? Or they just compute the next 10 with a new query. They can completely compute the next 10 with a new query, which is going to be the centroid, which is sort of more closer to the centroid of the relevant documents and more distant from the centroid of the irrelevant documents. Okay, this idea, I'll come back to it next class, but let me show you this. This idea is called relevance feedback. So you are taking for the next 10, to get the next 10 results, you're going to use the information that the user has implicitly provided to you about which ones are relevant and irrelevant in the first 10 results. Okay, now if in fact the user has said of the documents, of the universe of documents, these are the relevant ones and these are the irrelevant ones, then the perfect query that you should have run is to take the centroid of all the relevant documents minus the centroid of all the irrelevant documents. This would be the vector difference. It will be a new vector. Run that as the query on the universe of documents, you will get the most perfect results. And what you wind up doing when we come back next class is you don't have all the relevant and irrelevant documents. You just know among the first 10 what are the relevant and irrelevant documents. So what you do is rather than completely ignore the user's query, you sort of alpha times the original query plus beta times the centroid of the irrelevant, centroid of the relevant results in the first 10 minus gamma times the centroid of the irrelevant results in the first 10. So this way the query is slightly changed such that it's biased by the input that the user has given. This is called relevance feedback. This is also text classification. It's text classification being applied to generate the next query. Okay? And in fact, you could ask yourself, and you can come back and tell me on Thursday, in this beta and gamma, how do changing beta and gamma change? In the case of IR, what do you care about? Precision and recall. How do changing beta and gamma change precision and recall? We'll talk about this when you come back. Mm-hmm.